We're going to spend the hour talking to Ron Rivera. If you're a football fan, you know that name. Ron had an All-American college football career at Cal before being selected in the second round by the Bears. He spent his entire nine-year NFL career as a linebacker with Chicago and was part of their dominant defense in 1985 that won Super Bowl number 20. And after retiring, he went into coaching as the linebacker coach with the Eagles under Andy Reid. And then in 2005, Ron went back to Chicago as the Bears defensive coordinator on another trip to the Super Bowl, Super Bowl 41. And he is now the general manager of the Cal football program. We're ready to go. Good to have you with us on Sports Byline. Ron Rivera is with us in the studio. Ron had an All-America college football career at Cal before being selected in the second round by the Chicago Bears. He spent his entire nine-year NFL career as a linebacker with Chicago and was part of their dominant and arguably the NFL's all-time best defense in 1985 that won Super Bowl number 20 over the Patriots 46-10. And after retiring, he went into coaching as a linebacking coach with the Eagles under Andy Reid. He's credited with developing linebacker Jeremiah Trotter into a two-time All-Pro as the Eagles went to three straight NFC championship games. In 2005, Ron went back to Chicago as the Bears defensive coordinator and another trip to the Super Bowl, Super Bowl number 41. His coach and that success led to his first NFL head coaching job with the Carolina Panthers. He was the third Latino in NFL history to become a head coach following Tom Fears and Tom Flores. In 2015, Ron's Panther Club had the best year in franchise history, finishing 15-1, and they played in Super Bowl 50 against the Broncos, losing a defensive battle 24-10. His next stop as a head coach was with Washington, and it's safe to say it was a challenge with the team implementing a new culture, with the changing of the teams and nickname of the team to the Commanders, dealing with an altered season because of COVID, and his personal challenge of dealing with cancer and his treatment during the season. Now Rivera's career has come 360 as he's now the general manager of his alumni alma mater, Cal's football team. You grew up in a military family, and I know talking to Ronnie Lott one time, because he came from an Army family as well, he talked about the advantages of that, moving around all the place, the diversity, and also the flexibility. I was a military kid as well, so my dad was Air Force, and I know what he was talking about. There is something about being in a military family, especially if you're young, that is so beneficial.
Oh, very much so, Ron. I think the thing that, you know, separates us really is the way we grow up, you know, back in the day. I mean, today they don't move around as often as they used to, but when your dad got reassigned or your mother got reassigned, everybody went. I mean, we were in Heidelberg, Germany. We were in Fort Lewis, Washington. We were in Fort Meade, Maryland. We were in Fort Gulick, Panama. And our home base was Fort Ord, California, where my brothers and I were born. So, you know, and for me personally, it has come full circle because I've pretty much have come back to the West Coast, come back to this area. And my wife and I have a home down in Monterey.
Yeah, I also know one other thing, the discipline that's in a military family. You have jobs to do if you're a kid, and if you get in trouble, your dad gets in trouble. Mm-hmm. Your dad was an officer and everything. And I think that was a foundation that really helped me and others.
Well, one of the things you learn very quickly is you learn chain of command. And on the Army base, obviously, there's the base commander, and everything filters down. Well, at home, depending on what was needed, either mom was commander in chief or dad was commander in chief of the boys. It just depended on what the circumstances were. But you also learned discipline, you know, that you had to have things in order. Everything did have to be in order. Your yard had to be in order. The cars had to be washed. Why? Because the officer of the day, he patrolled the base. And if something didn't look right, you were called to task. It started with your father, and it trickled down to us. So we knew we had to do things the right way. So the culture pretty much was, you know, was about hard working. It was about discipline, and it was about chain of command.
How did you end up having a college career in college football at Cal?
Well, you know, growing up in the military is a little bit of a, for the most part, is a conservative, you know, period in your life. And going to Cal really kind of opened my eyes up to what the world was really about in other facets. And what happened for it, more so than anything else, Dad really appreciated education, you know. Dad didn't graduate from college. He went right into the military to help support his family in Puerto Rico. You know, it was a farming family, and there were 13 kids, and so Dad was one of the older sons, and so he goes to the military. But during his military career, he went back to school and graduated as he was serving our country. So to him, education was important. And when it came down to it, the decision was made based on a couple of things. Personally, for me, it was close to home was probably one of the most important things because we had traveled so much. And I wanted my family to be able to watch me play football easily. Secondly, education was very, very important. Dad talked about it constantly.
I got to ask you, what was the pitch like in your family when Joe Capp came in and tried to sell you on Cal? I've been trying to picture that because I know his personality, obviously. But what was that like?
Well, you know, for me, I was already there at Cal. But what Joe had to do was sell me on staying because, you know, I was very loyal to Coach Theater. But the one thing that Joe just kept hammering to me was, Ron, this is the University of California. It's not Stanford. It's not USC. It is the University of California. It is the primary one. It is the most important one. You can't leave. You're a California. I mean, that's what his pitch was all about, was what it meant to be at Cal, how important it was to be at Cal, especially if you're from the state of California.
He, of course, was a Cal quarterback of his own right. And I forgot, you had been there a couple of years before he came here. Yep. What was the last 2 years?
Yep, my last two.
Yeah. Okay, let me take you back. You know where I'm going with this. 1982, November afternoon, on the Cal campus, the big game, the big rivalry. And those type of rival games are always very special. I'm doing the broadcast on Stanford. Joe Starkey's doing the broadcast on Cal. Tell me what it was like from your perspective, that last play, what they called the play and everything. I'll set this up, by the way, in that Stanford took a late lead seconds before the end of the ball game, kickoff. Cal takes it, and as most people know, they lateraled it all over the field. They score the touchdown. It's just bedlam and everything. But tell me about your perspective on that.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that when that happens, and you're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, man, we ain't got a chance. What the heck? You know, I mean, and then as the play started to unfold and the ball was kept alive, you know, next thing you know, it's like, man, we got a chance. Wait a minute, something good. This is positive. And just like Joe Starkey says, the band's on the field. And then what happened was the referees gathered in the middle of the field right about, I think, the 28 or 30-yard line. And a bunch of us were kind of standing around trying to hear what they were saying. And then when we saw the head referee step aside and raise his hands, it was bedlam at that point.
Yeah, it was an amazing game. And, you know, I wasn't quite prepared for how that game was going to end because I'd never seen a play like that mm-hmm. before. But I focused in on it, and I had made the call that the game is over with because I had seen, as I mentioned to you some time ago, that I'd seen a referee down on the other side go like this because he was looking down the line. But it was the right call, the right end, and the right deserving result for the University of California.
Well, you know, that's one of those things that I think as you look at it, what it has meant to college athletics as well. You know what I mean? I mean, it's some people call it the greatest play in college football ever, and it was miraculous, but it has taken a life of its own, and it's still celebrated today.
What was your reaction to being drafted in the second round by the Bears?
I was thrilled. I was so excited. I mean, the draft process today is so much bigger than it was back then. You know, and one of the things that I wanted was, you know, I was just with my fiance at the time, who's my wife. We've been married almost 41 years now. And sitting there, just sitting on pins and needles and waiting for that opportunity to know where you're going to the NFL is one of the longest moments in your life, if you ask me, as a football player. But when I was picked, the excitement, the thrill of it all, and quite honestly, the relief that it's over. Now I know where I'm going to play in the NFL.
I think every franchise has its own personality.
Yes.
You know the Chicago Bears, the history of the linebackers there. You were a linebacker in every year. Wait, when you got into that organization, what did you see that you did not know before you got there?
Really was how fanatical the Bear fans were. I mean, it was an amazing thing. because, you know, we often had conversations about this amongst ourselves and amongst the other sports, because we got, you know, we got to know guys that played for the Cubs and the Bulls and the Blackhawks and the White Sox. And we used to talk about all the time, you know, the significance of being a professional athlete in Chicago and what it meant. And I mean, I learned so many great lessons from Mike Ditka about how important it was to be a professional athlete in Chicago. You know, one of the discussions were, if you had to rank the significance and importance of all the teams, how would you rank them? And we always used to talk about it. Was it the 85 Bears and then Michael Jordan and the Bulls? Or was it Michael Jordan and the Bulls, or was it the 85 Bears? I mean, that was always the conversation, was who was more significant. And then when the Cubs finally won their World Series, I believe it was, 2018 or something like that, it was finally celebrated. No, it was 2017. It was finally celebrated that, hey, they won their World Series. I mean, that was such a big deal. And it was an amazing thing. So the significance of being a professional athlete in Chicago was huge.
Ron Rivera is with us in the studio, and when we come back, we're going to talk about that great 85 team, arguably the best ever defensive team. They only lost one game that season, and of course, they took apart the New England Patriots. I was down there and covered that game. Very, very special. So we'll talk to Ron about that. We'll talk about what he's doing with the University of California football program now as we continue across the country. We continue with more of you and Sports Byline. Ron Rivera with us here on Sports Byline USA. You know, I've known Ron for a long time at a distance many times because he played his college ball at Cal. I was on television here. And, you know, as I watched your career and followed it, the one thing I thought about you was that you were consistent. Mm-hmm. And I always felt that that was something very important to you. Am I right about that observation?
You're very right about that, Ron. And a lot of it came from my father. Again, being in the military, you know, Dad, the one thing he always said was that, when things get rough, when things get tough, when it gets hard, everybody looks to the commanding officer. He tells the story that when he was in Vietnam and they had an attack from the Viet Cong, you know, mortars were coming in, arms fire was coming back and forth, and everybody turned to look to the colonel. Mm-hmm. And he stood up and started giving directions, and everybody calmed down and went right to work, and they repelled the attack. And he tells me this story right after I become the head coach of the Carolina Panthers. And he says, so Ronnie, when things get rough, things get tough, you got to be who you are. You can't change. You got to do your job. And that was it. And that was the only time my dad ever gave me advice on coaching football. Dad was a baseball player, loved baseball. Followed my career, but baseball was Dad's thing.
Great piece of advice. Let me ask you about those 85 Bears. Dominant, no doubt about it. Defensively, playoffs, they were almost unbeatable in the playoffs and then took apart the New England Patriots down in New Orleans. But I'm wondering, what was the catalyst? What was the glue? What was it that made that team so successful collectively?
I think what it was exactly what you said, was the collective leadership, starting with Mike Ditka and then Buddy Ryan. They both had their own perspectives on how they did things and what they believed in. And to Coach Ditka's credit, he allowed Buddy to be who Buddy was for the most part. And so because of that, you had this personality on offense that was being led by Coach Ditka and Jim McMahon. But then on the defensive side, it all started with Buddy Ryan. And that's the one thing you knew about the defense. The defense was run by Buddy Ryan. The way he called the defense, the way he prepared the defense, the way he prepared his game plans, and then the way he got us to execute it. Buddy was a tremendous motivator as well. Mike Ditka was one of the best motivators I've ever been around. Buddy had his way of motivation. He challenged you. He put it on you. He got you to recognize and realize what your strengths and weaknesses were very quickly. You know, and again, Buddy was a military man, served in Korea. And so a lot of the way he handled us as players was how he handled his soldiers when he was in Korea as well.
Let me give you a couple of names and tell you me the most impressionable thing about them. Mike Singletary.
Oh, intense. Intense about everything he did. Mike did things at a very high level intentionally. He's a very, very bright, thoughtful, hardworking man.
Dan Hampton.
Probably one of the greatest natural athletes that didn't look like an athlete. He was this big lumbering guy. But when you watched him play, you watched how explosive he was, how strong he was, naturally strong. And that was one of the things about who Dan was.
You know, the great personality, and I had him on the show a number of times, Steve McMichael.
Oh, Ming the Merciless.
That's it.
You know, great teammate. This is why I believe he got into the Hall of Fame, and I can remember Dan Pompey doing an article about Steve and why Steve belonged in the Hall of Fame, and he and I had this conversation during the interview, and I said to him, I said, the thing about Steve that everybody has to recognize and realize is he's got the defensive tackle he played next to him, and Dan Hampton is a Hall of Famer. The defensive end that played outside of him is a Hall of Famer, and the middle linebacker is a Hall of Famer. And people say, well, yeah, see, he played around a lot of great players. No. Sometimes you need a player that is best for the team, a guy that helps elevate everybody else's performance. But if you look at his own stats, like he's one of the top leading sackers as a defensive tackle. He played almost as the longest as a defensive tackle in the league. He had a tremendous career that tells you he deserves to be in it, but he got overlooked because of the people that were around him. So when he finally got in, it was an amazing thing, but deservedly so. I mean, I'm one of those that firmly believe that he should have been in sooner just because of his own individual records, but the fact that he made us all better. When Mike Singletary got hurt, he missed two games his entire career as our starting middle linebacker for Chicago Bears. I'm the only other guy to start. And in both those games, I led the team in tackles. Was I a great player? I was a good player. I really was. I don't know if I was a great player. I was a good player. I understood the game, but I know that because the guys that were in front of me, because of Dan Hampton, but mostly because of Steve McMichael, I was able to do my job and lead the team in tackles. I was able to replace Mike Singletary to the point where we didn't miss him. That's because of the guys that were around me. They played and they made me better.
You know, when I think of the great teams and the successful ones, complimentary is the word that comes to mind.
Yes. Yes, that's the right word. And if you wanted to use that for a Steve McMichael, you would be right on, because he was a very complimentary player.
The 46-10 win, I was on the field the day before the game where you guys went through the workout and everything, and I watched both the teams. And I knew at that moment that this was going to be a blowout. There was something about the way you all presented yourself in that practice, and then not that New England, you know, wasn't a solid team. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
No, because exactly where you were going with this was we had attitude. To me, attitude is one of the most important things that you can have. Anytime when you look at things and perceive things, your attitude dictates how you're going to do things. We used to get off the bus. That defense would get off the bus, and we were already up by 7 points. The ball hadn't even been kicked off. That was our attitude. That's how good we were. And for that one period, that one year in 1985, when we got off the bus, we felt like we were up.
After you retired, you did become a coach, and it was with Philadelphia. You were there. Andy Reid was the head coach. You all went to 3 NFC championship games, I believe.
Yes.
And what did you learn from that experience that helped you along the way?
Oh, I learned so many great lessons from Andy. People don't understand, but if you go back and you follow coaching trees, again, Andy's coaching tree works all the way back, connects to Bill Walsh. Okay. And Andy had a way of doing things, just like Coach Walsh did. He had something he believed in, and that's the way he did it. Well, Andy was the same way. Andy had something he believed in. Again, he worked for Mike Holmgren. Mike Holmgren worked for Bill Walsh. What Andy did more so than anything else that I will always appreciate was he taught me how to take ownership as a coach, how to make decisions and own the decisions. I had a situation with one of my linebackers, with Jeremiah Trotter, and I went to Andy and said, hey, coach, I got this issue, this problem, blah, blah. He looks at me and goes, Ron, take care of it. Come back to me later and let's talk about how you handled it. And we'll go from there. I said, sure, great. So I went back, talked to Trot, got things settled down. We went about the day, had a good practice. Later that afternoon, I went into Coach's office. We sat down and he said, well, so Ron, how'd you handle it? Well, I did this, this, and this, coach. And he goes, that's good. Hey, how about this? What if you had him do this, this, and this? I said, I didn't think of it. He says, Ron, sometimes, okay, as you think through things, there's sometimes other answers that may be better. Your answer is not a bad answer. but there might be a better one. It's the same thing with calling plays. People don't understand. There's not a bad call, okay? There can be a better call. But execution will determine whether or not it's a good or bad call.
We almost have to go to another break, but I will tell you, I have lived by this. 2 and 2 is 4, but so is 3 and 1. So is 1 and 3. All I care about is 4.
Mm-hmm. Get to you, the answer. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
When you got the head coaching job at Carolina, what were you prepared for that? Were you ready to be a head coach?
I would like to believe I was, but I learned quickly I wasn't because I needed a little bit of help.
And what help did you turn to?
Well, it was interesting because my first 2 years, I really didn't have anybody to rely on. I didn't have a former head coach on my staff. So what I did was, after my second season, I had this record of being 3-13 and games decided by 7 points or less, by score, basically. Well, at the end of the year, my first year, I did a whole review with the ownership. The second year, I did the same thing, sat down and did this entire review with Jerry Richardson, the former owner. When we finished the interview and I said, look, this is how I want to finish this. This is how I want to get better this year. This is how we can improve the team. We can work on the coaching like this. But I got to ask you one more thing, Mr. Richardson, that is, I need to develop myself, okay? I would like your permission to reach out to John Madden and ask him if he would not mind mentoring me. And at the time, I was on the Madden committee, but I wanted to have a formal relationship, more than just, you know, working on his committees. And so the owner, Jerry Richardson, he starts laughing a little bit, reaches in his coat pocket, pulls out this index card and slides it to me. Tells me, pick it up, look at it. I picked it up, looked at it, and it was John Madden's phone number. He said, Ron, you and I are thinking alike on this. You do need a little bit of help, and I think Coach Madden's the perfect guy. He's waiting for your phone call.
Ron Rivera is with us. We're going to talk a little bit longer about his pro career as a coach, and then we're going to be talking about the University of California football team. He's in charge of it now, and we'll talk about that. And also the changes in college football. Both of us have seen a lot of changes, and I still shake my head when I think about athletes getting paid. Not that they don't deserve it, but thinking about it anyway. We do that as we continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on Sports Byline. Ron Rivera is with us here on Sports Byline. First of all, let me say congratulations. New inductee into the Hispanic Football Hall of Fame.
Thank you.
Mean a lot to you?
It does. It means a tremendous amount. Mostly because, you know, being Latino, being Hispanic, I'm playing a game that's truly American. But at the same time, you know, just kind of being a trailblazer, you know, being somebody of my ethnicity, being able to compete and play at a high level, both collegiately and then in the NFL, you know, made me a role model. And it was a responsibility I truly took very, very seriously. And I knew that to be able to be accepted, I had to be good. So I practiced hard in college. I really did. Even to the point where some of my teammates ridiculed me. And it's basically, oh, okay, trying to be a weekday All-American, trying to be a Wednesday All-American. Well, kind of the joke was on them because eventually I became an All-American. And I think a lot of it had to do with was my approach because I had to prove I belonged.
You made an adjustment during your pro coaching career in the NFL, and I found it fascinating because in those early games that I would see you coaching, I thought to myself, go for it or do something different. Give them something to look at that they don't expect. And you eventually made the change. What caused that change?
My relationship with Coach Madden. When I reached out to Coach and he became my mentor, one of the things he said to me is, I understand you are 3-13 in games decided by 7 points or less. He said, go back and look at those games and see what you could have done differently. Well, again, I assumed, hey, this is homework. He wanted me to do a report. So I wrote this 20-page report about the game, the situation, the circumstances for those 13 games we lost. And so I fly out. I see Coach. I go to come over here to Pleasanton, go to Red Bear Ventures, his company. We sit down in his office. We have this great conversation. Then I bring up the report, and I said, here, I got this report that you wanted me to write. He goes, what report? I said, well, being 3-13. What should I have done differently? He says, well, that's not for me. That's for you. What do you think happened? And I said, well, you know, this instance, we were up by 3. I kicked a field goal to go up by 10, and you know, it was 4th and 1, long 1.5 on their 30. And I kicked a field goal instead of going for the first down to clinch it. He goes, exactly. He goes, Ron, think about it. And I did. So I went to another game. I said, well, here we had a 6-point lead and we were right around their 40-yard line. And I punted to get them in, you know, a coffin corner kick, the whole bit. They drive down, scored a touchdown, kicked the extra point, beat us. He says, what could you have done different? I said, I could have gone for it. And he goes, well, why didn't you? I said, well, I was going by the book. He looked at me and said, what book? I said, well, and at that instance is when I realized I was doing what was safe, not what was the best thing. And he says to me, he goes, Ron, you played enough, you've coached enough to know there are certain times you go for it and certain times you don't. From that point on, that's what I started to do. I started going for it when I felt we had the momentum, we had the personnel to do it, or I punted when I felt our kicker was doing great, our defense was playing hot.
The season you guys went 15-1, I would watch your games, and you dictated the tempo of that game.
Yes.
Every team against every team. You come in here to San Francisco, Super Bowl 50, you go up against the Denver Broncos. Looking back at that team, what was the catalyst of that team? I couldn't put my finger quite on it because they were talented players, but there was something driving them. What was behind that drive?
I think more so than anything else was their confidence and attitude and their belief in what we were doing and how we did it. One of the things that I always try to stress was always talked about culture and talked about core values. And if we could stick to these core values, if we could stick to these ideals, do things the right way, we'll put ourselves in position to win it. And for the most part, we put ourselves in position. We controlled that tempo. We controlled that momentum for the most part. But at the end, it did catch up to us at the very end, because what happened was going into training camp, we lost our number one wide receiver and people weren't trading number ones. So we had a good crew of receivers, but we didn't have a dominant number one. And that's what Denver exploited against us in the Super Bowl.
2020, you become the head coach of the Washington Redskins. And when I think back on that, I don't even have a question, because I want to ask you what that period of time was like for you, because there was turmoil. There was COVID going on. There was a name change for the Washington Redskins at that time. You had to deal with a major health question.
Well, the biggest thing, more than anything else, was I went into an area where it was a toxic situation. The culture wasn't what it needed to be. That was one of the hardest things. And then right in the middle of that, we had the George Floyd killing. And then we had the uprising about the name change. And those became, you know, really big deals. And there was a refocusing of that. And that's when the name change came in. And then when I was diagnosed with cancer, it changed everything for me personally. But I also understood my focus of the team. And so we announced it. We continued to coach and at the same time be treated. I was going to get treatments every morning for 35 straight days. I received 35 proton therapies and 3 cycles of chemo. And during that, we were right in the middle of the season, and we kept focusing on, as I used to tell the players, you know, be where your feet are and focus on what's important, not what's interesting. And during that period, when I would go get my treatments, it was all about the treatments. I didn't wonder about anything else. I stayed focused on, you know, getting healthy, taking care of myself. I was very fortunate to a degree that it was COVID, because what happened was getting to the hospital first thing in the morning, there was no rush hour traffic. There was no waiting in line at the hospital. In fact, I come to learn that supposedly that there was only one other person that was there before me, and she was on the Supreme Court and she was getting cancer treatments in front of me. But we never saw her because there's always security in and out, from what I was told. But I would come get my treatments, and then I would focus on getting healthy. And then once that was done, I would go back to the facility and we would start our day.
Looking forward, and you said to me before we started the interview, you thought you had more football in you, probably from a coaching standpoint, but yet you found yourself coming home, coming to the University of California, being the general manager of their football program. First of all, where the heck did general managers of college football teams come from?
You know, that's something that came up. Our chancellor was wondering about the concept. And so after the ESPN game day, Miami game, that whole Saturday. Chancellor reached out to my wife. It was right after the Stanford game. She reached out to my wife and said to Stephanie, she said, Stephanie, because Stephanie's on the board of trustees. So he calls her and says, hey, I'd like to talk to Ron. I need to understand a few things about football. I'm really interested in the concept of general manager. And so she says, sure, give Ron a call. So he calls me. He asked me the question, hey, what does an NFL GM do? I said, well, I start to describe it. So then he says to me, how does that translate to college? I said, you know what, Chancellor, I can write you a job description of what it should look like. So I did. I sent it to him, and he reached back out, and we started talking about what this concept looked like. And then come January, at some point, he reaches out, and we start talking about the whole concept and idea again. And he says to me, he says, yeah, I talked to some people, and some people have told me, you know, you really need to find a guy to do that job. You need to find someone that could come in and be general manager of Cal's football program, somebody that can be over the top, help direct it, make football decisions, and give credibility to the program again. And I said, great, how can I help you? He goes, well, you're that guy. And that's how it came about. That's how it started. And it was back in January of last season.
It's very interesting because I take a look at college athletics and never thought I'd see the day when we would have NIL money. I would never thought we'd see a portal mm-hmm. where you're there 1 year, gone to another school. And it really has hurt, I think, the culture of college football.
Yes.
The alumni being able to relate to the athlete on the yes. field. There's a number of things that are negative about it. We've even had some problems now with college athletes and gambling.
Yes.
Yeah, we knew that was going to come into the whole thing. Is there a path, either one or two or three paths, Ron, that can get a program like you're dealing with, any program mm-hmm. that has the challenges of college athletics today, going in a way that everybody is comfortable with it?
There is, but I think a couple things have to take place first and foremost. First of all, so that it gets back to the equity of playing the game, like the NFL. One of the greatest things they've done is they've been able to collectively bargain this situation. We got to figure out how we can do it in college athletics. Secondly, they have a salary cap that is they have to be true to. You have to stay within this salary cap. Okay, that's what revenue share is all about. That's what the judge decided was. She believed that there is money that's being made by the NCAA and it should be shared to a degree. And she determined at 20.5 this past season right. was what should be shared. Okay, so what comes into play is what's called NIL, name, image, and likeness. Well, that comes along. That's the advertising part. That's the marketing portion, okay? And so where I see the problem is, this is not true marketing as much as it is finding a way to get money through this window of opportunity to spend on a player is pay to play. If you control how NIL really is, okay, that's the marketing, the advertising aspect of it, then you would stop seeing this large amounts of money being thrown around. That's the truth. Because if you go back and look at the NFL – I had a salary cap. That's what I got paid. As a player, okay, I got to do commercials. I did a couple commercials. I did a couple TV advertisements. I did a couple newspaper advertisements. And a group of us did an advertisement one time, and this group got paid $5,000. But one guy, the quarterback, got paid $25,000. That's NIL. That's how it's supposed to be. Why? Because of who he is and where he is. To see the money being thrown around, being paid to college kids, and you sit there and go, wait a minute. That guy deserves to get paid more for a commercial than a guy that's been in the NFL for 5 years. That doesn't make sense to me. How can you justify that? So at some point, I think the NCAA, the CSC, the people that regulate what's going on, I think those are the things that need to be challenged. Why? Because if you bring that down to what the value really is, not what somebody says it is, but what it really is, a comparison to what's going on in the NFL, I think you can control it. Because to me, what I really want to see is if you stick to that salary cap, I want to see who the great coaches are. That's what I want to see. It's easy to be a great coach when you can outspend everybody and get all the best players. But be a good coach. Be a great coach when everything's even. That's what's so impressive about guys like Bill Walsh, okay, that was able to do what he did but have to do it under the constraints of a salary cap, okay? That to me is important. That to me signifies who great coaches are. do that when it's like that, not when you are able to buy the best player.
We have a little bit less than 2 minutes left, and I have to ask the big question is, you got the big dogs, the SEC, the Big Ten, mm-hmm. and everything. Do you think they will get the message that they have to do what's good for college athletics overall? Because that's the real key. Everybody has their own vested interest.
Well, what's interesting is, and again, when you talk to certain coaches and you talk to certain people in positions of authority at some of these universities in those conferences, they want to see it all equal. They want to see a fair fight. But when they get together and they're amongst themselves, it's like everybody wants, well, what's the advantage? How can we stay ahead of people? It's like people are afraid to do what's right. Okay? You do it because it's the right thing to do. Not because it's easy or hard. You do it because it's right. If you really want to see just how good you really are, or how are you really spending your money correctly on these individuals, make it fair. Make it a fair fight. You know, as I'm saying, you know, put the guns down and let's use your own physical brawn.
In 45 seconds, what's your goal for Cal's football?
I think to become beyond relevant, to be part of what's going on in the NCAAs, to be able to compete at a high level. And we're doing it not selfishly because it's just all about football, but because it's about the university. We have 29 total sports, 29 Olympic sports. We are one of the pathways to the Olympic teams in America and the Olympic teams internationally because of the international students that compete for the university. That's what we're doing it for. The reason we're doing it for is because if we become relevant and we generate the kind of revenue that can support the entire athletic department, we can have that kind of program that when it's Olympic time, which we're going to see in a few years, several of those athletes from our Olympics teams are going to play for the United States. And several of them will play for their home countries internationally.
Ron Rivera, you make so much sense. I'm so glad you're back home and also running the Cal football program there. You know, the things that you said are very, very meaningful, and I think the Cal is in good hands. Let me put it that way. Thank you, my friend.
No, thank you, Ron. Appreciate your time.
Ron Rivera with us, of course, All-American college football player at Cal, also played in the NFL 9 seasons with the Chicago Bears, won a Super Bowl. We continue with more of you and Sports Byline. That's going to wrap up this hour of Sports Byline. Interesting hour in conversation with Ron Rivera. He's now the general manager of the Cal football program. And, of course, Ron had an All-American college football career at Cal before being selected in the second round by the Bears. He went on to spend his entire 9-year NFL career as a linebacker with Chicago and was part of their dominant defense back in 1985 when they won Super Bowl number 20. And after retiring, he went into coaching as a linebacker coach with the Eagles, and also went back to Chicago as their defensive coordinator when they went to Super Bowl 41. And Ron has had great success as an assistant coach and became a head coach then with the Washington Ball Club in the NFL and also with Carolina. But stick around. I'm coming right back with more of you and America's Sports Talk Show.